Good morning. Voters head to the polls today for a critical swing state primary.
Michigan is a state that Democrats cannot afford to lose if they have any hope of winning the Senate majority this year.
How President Trump is pushing for vaccine changes behind closed doors. And a tiny country takes a big leap and alters its name. It's Tuesday, August 4th. I'm Gideon Resnick in for Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. Today, voters will decide what Democrat they want to represent them in a crucial Michigan Senate race in November, one that the party likely needs to win to gain control of the chamber. And their options, in many ways, represent ideological and personality-driven choices that voters in primaries across the country have been making. The race has turned into an intense and well-funded contest. A moderate establishment candidate, four-term Congresswoman Haley Stevens, is up against Abdul El-Sayed, a former public health official who's fired up the progressive wing of the party.
He's running in some ways to be the Democratic nominee by running against the Democratic Party.
Russell Berman is a staff writer for The Atlantic who spent time in Michigan covering the race. He says the Democratic Party is unpopular there, which El-Sayed is using to connect with dissatisfied voters.
He's one of the harshest critics of the Democratic Party, and yet, of course, he's running to be their candidate. He basically criticizes Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, as much as he criticizes President Trump.
El-Sayed's anti-establishment stance has attracted the support of high-profile progressives, like New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
A key to a lot of his support is especially younger voters and more progressive voters are not getting excited about anybody who is a conventional candidate with a conventional political resume. And there's really no more conventional political resume than Haley Stevens.
She worked on President Obama's auto industry rescue team and is supported by Schumer and a number of Michigan's top Democrats, including Governor Gretchen Whitmer. A major source of division in the race, much like the Democratic Party at large, has been the war in Gaza and support for Israel. AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobbying group, has spent tens of millions of dollars on ads supporting Stevens. She describes herself as a pro-Israel Democrat, but has often been critical of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. El-Sayed is an outspoken opponent of American aid to Israel. He's accused Netanyahu of committing genocide in Gaza, and he criticized Stevens for accepting AIPAC money at their final debate last week.
The difference between us is $46 million of AIPAC spending. They know that she'll be a reliable vote, just like she took last week to send your tax dollars to a foreign government that is aiding, arming, and abetting the very people who want to foreclose on the possibility of Palestinian self-determination. I believe that we should not be fighting stupid wars that AIPAC wants us to fight in the first place. And I believe we have a responsibility to keep our money here, to invest here. That really is the difference.
The race is raising questions about what brand of candidate, progressive or moderate, gives Democrats the best chance in November against the likely Republican candidate, former Congressman Mike Rogers. He very nearly won Michigan's other Senate seat just 2 years ago.
Rogers is, as Republican Senate candidates go, one of the strongest that they've recruited in the country and maybe the strongest that they could have gotten in Michigan.
Across the country, progressive Democrats have seen success in deep blue cities like New York, Denver, and Washington, D.C. And polls largely show El-Sayed with a lead over Stevens in the primary. But some Democrats are worried that a progressive candidate would have more of a challenge statewide, especially in a battleground.
And of course, the big concern, right, is whether El-Sayed is simply too far left for a purple state that President Trump won both in 2016 and most recently in 2024.
In their last debate, Stevens made her case on electability.
Governor Whitmer, Attorney General Nessel, the chair of the Michigan Legislative Black Caucus, Amos O'Neill, they all agree that I will be Michigan's workhorse, that I will stand up for us on day one, that I will beat Mike Rogers just like I have beat Republicans four times over.
And there is some research that shows candidates closer to the ideological middle tend to outperform those further away from it in general elections. But there are no ironclad rules in politics. If El-Sayed does win today and goes on to prevail in November, the race could become a major data point in the party's strategy for the presidential primary in 2028.
if El-Sayed can win not only the primary, but the general election in November, progressives are going to see this as a huge victory for their movement, because they're going to be able to look to Michigan, point to Michigan, and say the Democratic Party's theories and beliefs about quote-unquote electability in a purple state, in a swing state, are completely outdated.
The United States has recorded more measles cases this year than in any other year since the virus was declared eliminated in 2000. It comes amid a years-long decline in measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR vaccination rates in children. And more recently, as the Department of Health and Human Services has been led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a major critic of vaccines. This past weekend, he said in an interview with CNN's Dana Bash that parents should get the vaccine for their kids.
Are you willing to say to parents who have not vaccinated their kids that they should vaccinate their kids for measles because it is safe and it will help them save their children's lives?
Parents should get their children vaccinated for measles. A measles vaccine is effective. It stops measles in about 97% of the cases. Well, people should get vaccinated.
I thought it was one of his clearest endorsements of the MMR vaccine that he's made thus far.
Liz Essley White is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal.
We saw him do some of that early on, but it was usually paired with vaccination as a personal choice or another statement that would lead parents to believe that his recommendation wasn't 100%.
The public comments follow recent reporting from White that privately, it's been President Trump that has been forceful on vaccine changes. She told us about a conversation at a private lunch in May.
The president pushed Kennedy on why he wasn't doing more to probe what is in President Trump's mind, the connection between vaccines and autism. And this came as a surprise to Kennedy. He was taken aback, according to our sources, because he had been told by White House aides, you know, we need to kind of tamp down some of this vaccine rhetoric ahead of the midterms because it's not polling well.
According to White, Trump received COVID and flu shots last year, but has remained skeptical of childhood vaccines, particularly the MMR shot, which he has said he wants to break up into different shots. A long list of studies over the years have shown no connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. Kennedy has taken a considerable amount of action to try and change childhood vaccines, including firing a CDC vaccine panel and replacing them with many anti-vaccine voices. And earlier this year, trying to reduce the number of vaccines scheduled for children.
The American Academy of Pediatrics sued, and the judge ruled in favor of the pediatricians. So now that is stuck. But this is part of the bone of contention with the president and the health secretary right now. The president has urged Kennedy to go after this activist judge, as he considers him.
Scientists have said there is no reason to pare back the schedule. And Trump's push is going against the advice of some advisors, who found that vaccine skepticism is less popular with voters than other Kennedy-focused topics like food reforms.
Trump's own pollster found last winter that the vaccine skepticism from the administration was unpopular with voters. And another survey found in June, adults say they trust health information from their own doctors, while only 34% said they trusted it from Kennedy. So there is a real sense that they've done a lot on vaccines in the last year, but it hasn't held up in court, and then it's not doing well in the court of public opinion either.
An HHS spokesperson told the Journal that Kennedy and Trump were aligned in, quote, confronting the chronic disease epidemic facing children in America. Baltimore wants to overhaul how it responds to 911 calls to help people who may need social services rather than a squad car. Every year, the city gets tens of thousands of calls that don't really require a response from your typical first responders, police or firefighters or EMS. So this year, Baltimore is expanding its branch of first responders to help people who need support but aren't necessarily experiencing a life-threatening emergency.
It might be someone yelling in a park or someone who doesn't have the resources they need and is stuck at a gas station, possibly like a mother who has just left a domestic abuse situation and their child and her need diapers and food for a couple of nights.
Scott Massioni covers health for WYPR News in Baltimore. He says when police respond to situations involving someone going through a mental health crisis, people often end up in jail, the hospital, or worse.
And unfortunately, you know, that person may act in an erratic way, and police officers may take that as a form of violence, and it ends up tragically where someone dies. Whereas in this situation, a social worker may go out, they're more trained in the empathetic and compassionate ways that they can talk to people like this. And that way, they can hopefully get them calm and get them into a situation where they go to a hospital or go to a clinic or just really get the help that they need.
For years, Baltimore has run a more limited version of this program, which primarily focused on mental health support. According to the National Alliance on Mental Health, there are about 2,700 programs like that across the country. But now, a unique circumstance is going to let the city dramatically expand its offerings. Baltimore is using $15 million it received from recent legal settlements with companies involved in the opioid epidemic. The money will allow for the new system to run around the clock and let responders address a wider variety of crises. Now, only a handful of other U.S. cities have tried something like this at this scale. In Durham, North Carolina, officials have been running a similar program for 4 years with some promising results. The city has diverted over 21,000 calls that would have gone to police, and it said police backup was only needed for a small percentage of those calls, something like 0.01% of cases.
These people are well-trained for what they're doing and also know when to call for backup if they actually need it.
Durham's 911 response time has also sped up for all types of calls. Baltimore hopes for similar results as it rolls out the expanded program later this year. Here are a few other stories we're following today. State health officials in Michigan said that two people died in the state's cyclosporiasis outbreak, marking the first reported fatalities since the outbreak began in May. The state's health department stressed that both people had significant underlying health conditions. And while the illness can be deeply unpleasant, the CDC said that it is rarely fatal. Contaminated iceberg lettuce from Taylor Farms has been linked to the outbreak in Michigan and a number of other states. Michigan's overall case count is over 11,000. The U.S. outbreak is believed to be the largest on record. The Senate is set to hold a vote to advance the nomination of President Trump's Attorney General nominee Todd Blanche today. And his path to confirmation got a lot clearer after two Republican holdouts agreed on Monday to support him. Senators John Cornyn and Tom Tillis had stalled the nomination over concerns about a settlement agreement between Trump and the IRS. It involved the creation of a $1.8 billion payout fund for people who claim to be victims of political prosecutions, and it gave Trump, his family, and his companies immunity from tax audits. Blanche issued a memo on Sunday formally eliminating the payout fund, and he clarified that the audit agreement only protects the Trumps from investigations into past tax filings, but it doesn't rule out future tax audits. And finally, one of the world's smallest countries is getting a name change. Nauru, the island nation in the South Pacific formerly spelled N-A-U-R-U, will now be going by Nauero, N-A-O-E-R-O, which is more in line with how its residents refer to the country. The country's parliament unanimously approved the name change earlier this year, and President David Adjong said the move will honor the country's heritage and identity. Nauero has about 12,000 residents and was administered by Germany and Australia before it became independent in 1968. Now the country will rename national aircrafts and ships, and the website of the UN has already been updated to reflect the will of the country's leaders. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening to the News app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Rolling Stone goes deep inside the frantic search for Nolan Wells, a Mississippi teenager who disappeared during a boating trip with friends and whose death sparked a national conversation. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story, and I'll be back with the news tomorrow.